QSO Today, Episode 121, Dale Green, VE7SV. QSO Today is listener-sponsored by you. Options for being a QSO Today supporter are on the right side of the show notes page. Please become a listener sponsor today. For more information, please visit the QSO Today website at www.qsotoday.com and click on the support menu option at the top of the page. Welcome to the QSO Today podcast. I'm Eric Guth for Z1UG, your host. My QSO Today is with Dale Green, VE7SV, the 2013 CQ Contest Hall of Fame winner, who chases the endless summer by dividing his time between his homes in Renaca Beach, Chile, and Chilliwack, British Columbia. Dale operates a contest superstation for over 20 years in Canada, where he has honed his skills to become one of the top contesters in the world. When he operates in Chile, he is CE2AWW. VE7SV, this is Eric, 4Z1UG. Are you there, Dale?
Yes, good morning, Eric. This is Dale, VE7SV, also Charlie Echo 2 Alpha Whiskey Whiskey, and right now I'm in Viña del Mar, Chile.
Well, we'll talk about that a little bit later in the podcast, but Dale, thanks for joining me on the QSO Today podcast. Can we start at the very beginning of your ham radio story? When and how did it start for you?
Well, it was a long, long time ago, back when I was a young lad. I was in Boy Scouts. I was 13 years old, and that was about 1957. And I was collecting badges. And one of the badges was for learning the Morse code. So I set about learning the Morse code and learned the Morse code. And at that time, my father, who had been in the Canadian Navy as a wireless operator on board ship, saw my interest in the Morse code and dragged out an old Hallicrafter's S-38 receiver that he had in storage. And he had always been interested in radio and had always thought of getting his ham license, but never had. So with my interest, he dragged out the radio and we began to listen around to shortwave. And he explained to me about amateur radio. And I became very interested. But at that time in Canada, in the late 1950s, one had to be 15 years old before you could sit for your amateur license. And being 13, I was not able to do that. But I still had an interest. I practiced the code. And with that continued interest, my father decided, well, it was time for him to get a license. So in 1958, he wrote the exam and became V7AGC, Alpha Golf Charlie, which enabled me to become even more interested, or encouraged me to become more interested in amateur radio, and indeed actually was making QSOs before my 15th birthday using his call sign.
What was your father's name?
My father's name was Earl, and he was very, very active from 1959 through to his death a few years ago, about 5 years ago.
And so it, for him, it became a lifelong passion as well.
Yes, it did. And in fact, we were able to go on several de-expeditions together. We went to the Cayman Islands and to other interesting places and really enjoyed the hobby together.
Okay, so when you became 15 years of age, you sat down and wrote the test?
On my 15th birthday, I was sitting in the office of the Department of Transport, which is the communications office in Canada at that time, and wrote and passed my amateur exam. Of course, in those days, CW was required, a written exam. We had to draw diagrams of receivers and transmitters, much more complex than what it takes to get a license today.
What was your call sign?
My first call sign was VE7BFN, Bravo, Foxtrot, November.
Were there different levels of licenses in those days in Canada?
Yes, there was. The first license class, you had to proceed through the steps. You could not just go automatically to the highest levels. So you passed the first license, and then you had to remain on CW for the first year. And after that time, you had to take your logbook and show activity. And then if you showed that activity, you were allowed to write the next level, which was the advanced level, had a higher CW requirement and a more advanced written exam. I did that 1 year later and received the advanced license, which then allowed me to operate on phone as well as CW, all modes, all bands.
Your first license was kind of like the American novice class?
Well, sort of, but not really, because we were able to operate with up to 1 kW and all.
Oh, really?
So it was only a restriction from the point of view that before you received phone privileges and also unlimited privileges, they wanted to make sure that you were active. In other words, if you were not active on CW during the 1 year period, they would not allow you to proceed.
What did you think about that 1 year process? You know, being required to go through that 1 year process before upgrading to phone.
It was easy at the time, but I think today's encouragement of activity and with no code licensing is basically a good thing. Anything that we can do to stimulate growth in our hobby. At 14 year or 15 years old, of course, everything was easy, and CW was always extremely easy for me, and therefore, you know, I certainly had no problem with it, but many other people did.
In addition to your father, did you have other Elmers that helped you along?
Yes, many, many. And today I still have Elmers throughout my life in amateur radio, which is now 55 years or so. I still have Elmers who help me with many aspects of the hobby, encourage me to experiment in some of the new modes. And this hobby has been a lifetime of learning for me.
Are there any Elmers that you want to call out?
Well, of course, my father being first and foremost, and then shortly after, Ted Toy, V7 Hotel Echo, helped me immensely. And not only did he help me amateur radio-wise, he was the first person to hire me. He was the director of telecommunications for then Pacific Western Airlines, that later morphed into Canadian Airlines and Air Canada, and that's where my career came after being hired by, as we fondly called him, Pop Toy. I spent my lifetime in aviation and retired from Air Canada 10 years ago after 30 years of service. So, yes, Ted Toy was a huge Elmer for me, both amateur radio-wise, but also work-wise.
You mentioned the Hallicrafters S38 receiver. Was that the receiver for your first rig?
It was not, in fact, because my mother and father were divorced, and my father had the station at his home, and I was living mainly with my mother at that time. So my first receiver was actually was a Hallicrafters, but a more modern S85.
And the transmitter?
And the transmitter was a homebrew 6AG7 tube crystal oscillator, and to just a long piece of wire strung from my bedroom back to the clothesline pole at the back of our property.
Even though you had 1,000 watts on your privileges in your first year, you were only operating 20, 30 watts or?
Well, 5 watts, but that only lasted for a very short time. I had many mentors and had seen the big DX stations even before I was licensed and was going to field day. So I knew what was out there. And so after about 10 days or so with a 6AG7 at 5 watts, I added a 2E26 final to it to bring the power up to 50 watts. And then 6 months later on my birthday, my father arrived at my home with a Heathkit DX40 as my birthday present and my first commercial rig. And by the end of that year, for Christmas, our project was to build a linear amplifier, an 813 that ran about 500 watts. So I went from 5 watts to a kilowatt within about a 6 month period of time.
Wow, how about that? And what kind of antenna did you have on the roof?
Well, we started with, like I say, just this long piece of wire that soon was replaced again by the end of the year with a two-element cubicle quad that operated on 10, 15, and 20. So, you know, considering that was 1959, that was a pretty reasonable station, the S85 DX40 813 amplifier and the two-element quad, and I was working the world. And remember, 1959 was probably the best sunspot cycle ever, so the bands were just wonderful. And as a young 15-year-old guy, I was just enthralled with working the world.
What's your current rig?
I have two stations, as one station in Canada, in British Columbia, where I spend the Canadian summer, and then the other station here in at Reñaca Beach in Chile, and we spend the Chilean summer. So I live in eternal summer and never want to live in winter.
I'm envious.
But at both stations, I use the Elecraft K3. I have one of them here in Chile, and I have two of them at my contest station on Mount Tom near Vancouver in British Columbia.
Do you use the pan adapter or any of the other goodies that go along with the K3?
I don't. We use basic stripped-down K3s, and for contesting, they are just an excellent radio. I enjoy both sideband and CW contesting, but these days I'm more of a CW operator, and the Elecraft K3 are just wonderful radios, especially for CW contesting.
You also have a vintage station.
Yes, I do. I have a Drake 2B and a Johnson Viking Ranger that gets put on the air only every couple of years, but it's all equipment that was used by me over the years. The Viking Ranger, in fact, was my father's, and when he upgraded to more modern equipment, we decided to keep it and put it on the shelf, and now it is one of the things that reminds me of him, certainly whenever I look at it.
And it's on its own desk, right?
Yes, it is. It just sort of sits in a corner of the shack in British Columbia. The Drake 2B was used by me in about 1960, when I was hired by Pacific Western Airlines, and I was hired as a radio operator to go to the Arctic, to the Canadian Arctic, and man a weather station and an undirectional beacon station for VFR aviation in the Arctic. And while there, I was first VE8 Alpha Alpha and later VE8 Radio Radio on two separate stints in the Arctic, and that Drake-2B was part of my station from those days.
Do you think your being stationed in the Arctic has caused you to pursue endless summer?
It certainly did to some extent, because that after my second stint in the Arctic, for a number of years I lived in the Cayman Islands and was ZF1 Sierra Victor in the late 1960s. And so yes, indeed, I've always had a love of the warm climates, although I must say, spending time in the Arctic was also a wonderful thing, and I got to see things that many people of the world only can imagine.
Yeah, it sounds great. Did ham radio play a part in the choices that you made for your education and career?
Always, it was a driver, and it continues to be. Life today with amateur radio is of prime importance. And indeed, this apartment that I live in at Reñaca Beach in Chile was bought with the ability to put antennas on the roof of the building. And it was part of the contract that I signed when I was buying the apartment. It was, "No antennas, I will not buy this apartment." And my wife fully understanding, and it was always the first question to be asked, "Will you allow antennas to be put on the building?"
Did you pursue higher education in electronics or engineering or anything like that?
Not to the engineering degree, but throughout my life, I was always taking courses to improve myself. Generally, they were summer courses or evening courses, and but they were short, specific courses that were specific to my career.
You referred to me by Scott Wright, K0MD, my guest on episode 116, who said that you were an avid DXer. When I read your biography, it appears that this passion started obviously very early. Can you talk about how your passion for DX developed?
Yes, and it actually goes back to even before being licensed. During the time that I was learning the code and being introduced to amateur radio, my father had a friend, John Brown, V7JB, who lived nearby within a few miles. And one day my father took me over to meet John and to see his station. And he was a huge station of that time, and had a Collins 75A4, a Viking KW stack Yagis. And my earliest recollection is going there as a 13 or 14-year-old, listening to him work stations and talk about wonderful things in the Pacific, in particular, with VKs and ZLs, and sitting on the floor of his shack and perusing QSL cards that he had received from all over the world. And I would see a QSL card from some part of the world and ask questions, and that was really the beginning of my interest in knowing about places far away and wanting to talk with people in those far-off places.
Yeah, a great way to learn geography, don't you think?
Yes, indeed. And I excelled at geography, little else, but geography I knew when I was in high school.
So, how did your DX life then develop from that point, once you had your license?
Well, immediately I wanted to talk far away. So even when I was running 5 watts, it was, "Can I make a QSO with the East Coast?" I was even running 5 watts, I was able to work a station in Russia, UA0 on 40 meters. So that desire was there almost immediately. And as the station grew, the reason for it growing was so that I could reach out further and further talk to people and make friends around the world, which I indeed did. We developed many friendships with amateurs who have been lifelong, people like Marty Lane, OH2BH. We were both 16-year-old kids learning about the world, a friend in Russia who remains a friend today. He's R7 Kilo Zulu in the Crimea. And to the point that we have all visited each other's homes, know the wives, know the children, and know the life of one another. And to me, that is one of the extremely important parts of amateur radio, is just not making the QSOs, but it's making the friends and acquaintances that that endure through a lifetime.
Is it possible, I read somewhere when you were stationed in the Arctic, that you worked DXCC in a single sitting?
Yes, that's true.
Could you talk about that story, how that worked out?
Sure. One of the few fellows that was at the Contoito Lake radio station was Reg Beck, V7IG, a friend. He was VE8RG. And when I arrived for my first day of work, which meant that I was flown in from Yellowknife, 250 kilometers away, to begin my tour of duty in isolation, Reg said to me, "Go to the shack and make some QSOs, and I'll call you when it's time for you to go on your shift." Well, I knew what time my first shift was to begin, and he didn't call me. And so I went in and said, "Reg, it's time for me to go on shift." He says, "You go back to the radio, and when you have worked DXCC, then it will be time to begin your work." So in a single sitting, I worked DXCC. It was as VE7BFN / VE8, and months later, I was able to get a VE8 call sign, and that call sign was VE8AA. But that was my first sitting of amateur radio at VE8.
So there was some geographical advantage to being up in the Arctic Circle and to be able to work all these countries in a single sitting?
Yes, it was geographical, but more so the rarity of the call sign. The Canadian Arctic is very, very lightly populated, and the number of amateurs, particularly back in 1959, was probably less than 10 active amateurs.
Oh, so they were calling you. All they had to do was hear your call sign.
That's right. It was just an endless pileup.
Oh, amazing. It's my understanding that you participate in de-expeditions. And have participated in de-expeditions. Is there a single one that was the most memorable and probably the most life-changing for you?
Probably one of the first was while I was in the Arctic, again working for an airline. We had the ability to travel, and we were working while we were in the Arctic. We worked 3 months on and 1 month off, and then later we worked 1 month on and 1 month off. So invariably, I tried to travel and go to interesting places and always meet amateur radio operators. And indeed, I carried that out throughout my career. Whenever I traveled overseas for work, I always tried to take a couple of days vacation tacked on or a weekend tacked on, in which I was able to meet amateur operators around the world. So it always was first and foremost in my mind. But anyway, getting back, we as an airline began to fly to the Cayman Islands in the early 1960s from Vancouver. And so my mentor, Ted Toy, V7HE, said to me as I was coming out one time, "Look, we were flying down to the Cayman Islands. Why don't you go along and take a rig and, spend some time there on your trip out of the Arctic?" So That was my first real deep expedition, and it showed me what fun it was to operate from other parts of the world, even with simple antennas.
What kind of rig would you carry in those days? And if you still do it, what kind of rig do you carry for a vacation?
At that time, I took a Helicrafters SR-150. They're certainly not as portable and easy to transport as the rigs today. But I took that down, and I took a vertical antenna, put it up on the beach at the hotel where I was staying, and had a wonderful couple of weeks of operating, again, back in the late 1960s or mid-1960s. The Cayman Islands was a relatively rare entity and much sought after by amateurs of the world. Today, I would take a K3, as do many, many of the de-expeditions. I don't know what percentage, but a very large percentage of the de-expeditions today are using the Elecraft K3 because of its portability. And also the lightweight amplifiers like the Elecraft KPA 500 or the Expert 1.3. Those amplifiers, weigh around 10 kilos and certainly easy to transport compared to the old days of people carrying huge radios and equipment.
And when you were flying with the airline, there probably wasn't necessarily a restriction on what you could carry in those days.
For me, there was not, of course, but and even today, we also seem to are allowed always a little extra, whereas the normal traveling public traveling is considerably more difficult.
It's my understanding that you built a contest station, a multi-operator contest station of your own. Can you describe its early beginnings and what kind of contesting does it support?
In the around 1970 or so, I had my station set up at my family home. And like many amateurs of those days, was affected by radio interference and television interference with the neighbors. And it was very frustrating when I wanted to operate. It seemed invariably my neighbors were wanting to watch television. And particularly during contest weekends when it was required to be on the air for 48 hours, my neighbors were not very thrilled that I was affecting their ability to watch television. So I decided at that time to look for a remote location with very few neighbors and thus being able to build a station and operate the contest without problem. I looked for almost a year, and after a year, I did find a location that was ideal, located on top of a mountain 100 kilometers east of Vancouver. And the mountain is called Mount Tom. It's near a small city called Chilliwack. And there I purchased 5 acres of land and began building my radio station. It required that I build a small home, which I did, a small 3-bedroom cedar home, and began building the station, first putting up one tower, then a second, then a third, and today we're up to 5 towers. And the station has transitions. First, it was for myself. But one of the things that I've learned and enjoy about amateur radio is sharing. And as the station developed, I got into multi-operating categories, multi-single, multi-two, multi-multi, which allowed friends to join me. We were able to encourage new amateurs to join us and develop a team for contesting. And that developed a philosophy of returning to the hobby through teaching, through sharing.
And during contests in your station, what role do you take?
It depends on the contest. It depends on the situation. I am a builder. I am a manager, but I am also an operator, and I love all those aspects, and they all continue to or all provide an opportunity to express different areas of learning and understanding the people that join me on any contest weekend.
I read someplace that you invite new and experienced contesters to your station. So you've got the novices and the more experienced contesters. How do you choose them, or do they choose you?
Both, but ultimately what we're looking for and have learned both from de-expeditions and from contesting is that compatibility is the first and foremost requirement and desirable trait of an individual to join the team. Because we can teach de-expedition knowledge, we can teach contest operating knowledge, but the ability to get along with people is something that is kind of an inbred thing. And so that's the first thing we look for, and indeed the most important aspect of team building.
You've been a member of the WRTC, the World Radio Team Championships, since its very beginning. Do you have a memorable or favorite WRTC story?
Yes, certainly the first one, which was in Seattle in 1990, when the Russians first came out from behind the Iron Curtain, and we were able to meet for the first time people that we had talked to for years as young fellows growing up, and meeting the various amateurs, the Russian amateurs, the contesters in Seattle at that first WRTC was a life-changing event.
You've done every one, right, since the very beginning. And so we're now, what, maybe 12 of them at this point?
I'm not sure of the number, but certainly many of them. And I'm one of the very few to have participated in all, and it's a wonderful honor to be chosen, either as a referee or as an operator. I have competed in all of them, I think, a couple of times as a referee for another team, and then other times as operator. In 1990, my teammate was Lee Sawkins, B7CC, mm-hmm. and he has been a teammate many times, and indeed in the last one, which was in Boston, we were teammates, as we were in Moscow and other times. So why do I do it? It's because I can, and it's a great honor to be chosen or to participate and earn a seat. It's not simply expressing a desire or expressing, I've got enough money to go, and so I want to be part. You must be selected.
And it's fun.
It's a great fun. And the contest is only a little part of the fun. And win or lose, we all at WRTC consider ourselves winners just to be there. And again, as I expressed earlier, the fraternity that has grown out of WRTC, the lifelong friendships, is to me more important than the actual contesting part of it. Do we go to win? We try, but as I said, we are winners just by being there.
Well, what kind of operators do you have? I mean, These are contest operators, DXers, both?
Contest operators, and the qualification process usually goes a number of years before the upcoming event. For example, the next one is going to be in Germany, and the qualifying is occurring now. So you must operate and place well in a number of contests over the years prior to the actual event in order to qualify.
So you could be a member of a team in a multi-operator station, or you could be an individual operating on your own in order to qualify for the WRTC.
That is correct, and there is different weighting applied to different categories. A single op does not compete directly against a multi-op operator. The multi-op station operator, the score is weighted to a lower factor than a single op. So there's a complex formula for arriving at points and who qualifies and who does not.
Have you ever been stymied by the weather or by Murphy's Law or anything like that when you've been out there in these contests in the WRTC?
All factors entered, and in Russia, we certainly had a big lightning and thunderstorm in the middle of the 24-hour period of WRTC. On some stations, indeed, stopped transmitting for an hour or so. Others were able to continue. We fortunately continued and did well.
As you mentioned earlier, you're talking to me from Chile right now. Could you talk a little bit more about how you ended up in Chile specifically? I mean, I've heard of other people going to other locations south of the border for endless summer. How did you end up in Chile?
Well, again, it relates back to my airline days, and Air Canada was flying to Chile, and part of my work brought me here many times during my work career. And on one of those trips, I met a young fellow, CE3, Charlie Tango, Roberto Ramirez. And after I retired from Air Canada, one day he called and said, "Dale, are you interested in coming to Chile to work for a month and help me out at the company I work for in the cell phone industry?" And I said, "Well, I don't know anything about cell phones other than how to turn them on." And he said, "Yes, but you've got lots of communications experience. And what more," he said, "you're very, very good at team building. And what we need here is to build a team in my department." So I said, "Okay, well, that sounds great. I'll come for a month and it'll be like a vacation." So I came for a month. A month turned into 2 months. 2 months turned into a year. And then after a year, I said, "Look, I'm retired. I'm not interested in working." But it showed to me what a wonderful place Chile indeed is. And I decided to emigrate, and now I have status. I have landed immigrant status and live half the year here at Reñaca, which is on the coast west of Santiago.
It's my understanding from my last episode, which was with Dino Basomi, I think CE3PG, that Chile has, or Chile gets 70% of the earthquakes that happen in the world. Are you involved when you're there with emergency communications when earthquakes strike?
You know, I am not, but there are, through the Dino's group, the Radio Club of Chile, which he's the president, they have some excellent programs, and there are ongoing excellent programs throughout Chile for communications. And I know in a number of earthquakes in the last 5 years or so that amateur radio has played a very important part in providing the first responder communications.
So all in all, Chile is also a great place for amateur radio, and it has a very active ham community.
It indeed does, and it's growing. The number of contesters and DXs are growing, but also those interested in the new digital modes and all aspects of amateur radio is alive and well here in Chile.
You were inducted into the CQ Contest Hall of Fame in 2013 at the Dayton Hamvention. Is this award the top award for the amateur radio contester? And how did you feel when you received this award?
I'm still amazed and thrilled, and it's hard to believe even. Certainly, it's a group of amateurs that have been selected that are well recognized worldwide. And one of the key factors is giving back to the hobby and not just necessarily winning contests, although, you know, that certainly is part of it.
So having a well-rounded portfolio in the contest sphere and being an Elmer is a key part of it.
Absolutely. And it was largely due to my mentoring at the contest station in British Columbia, and also mentoring young amateurs here in Chile, CE3CT, who I mentioned earlier. When I first met him, was a young amateur with a small station in an apartment building. Today, he now lives on an acreage with several towers, stacked Yagis, and a very, very serious contest station, of which I helped design, build, and still operate at today with the locals.
What kind of impact does ham radio or has ham radio had on your family life?
It's it's always difficult being a passionate person with any hobby, I believe, whether that passion be car racing or stamp collecting. It takes time away from what otherwise might be spent with the family. But it also, I think, rounds out an individual. It makes their life fuller, and also those around you, your spouse, your children. In the case of amateur radio, all of the family has got to meet people from around the world that otherwise they would not have. And that, I think, is a very, very important thing. So, yes, it does affect. And yes, I spend a lot of time at the radio. But I also think that my spouse is very content to know that I'm doing what I love. And although she has no interest in the actual QSO or part, she is always thrilled when we have visitors from around the world, and on a regular basis, we do entertain visitors from the ham radio community.
What excites you the most about what is happening in amateur radio today?
I think this part of knowing and friendship beyond the operating is for me one of the most exciting things. Recently, we had here in Viña del Mar, the IARU Region 2, I think it's Region 2 group, and had many amateurs from North and South America, indeed even G3BJ from England. And I was thrilled to be able to host a cocktail party on my rooftop terrace for those people. That was more interesting and exciting for me, or as interesting, exciting for me as making a new DX contact.
So just the wide world of people and the wide variety of people that you come in contact with is the thing that most excites you about ham radio.
It does, and as I said, it went back right almost to the early days of travel, when I was in my late teens and early 20s. It was traveling and meeting people, and you know, these people remain friends today. And in Scott's QSO today, he mentioned meeting King Hussein, or not meeting King Hussein, almost meeting King Hussein. Well, my story is that I indeed did meet King Hussein, and it was because of amateur radio.
How did you meet King Hussein? What's that story?
King Hussein was traveling in Canada and came to British Columbia. And a friend of mine, jokingly, because I had worked King Hussein, JY1, a number of times on the bands, said, "Dale, he's probably going to phone you up and want to meet you." And I said, "Yeah, sure. I doubt that very much." Well, one day the phone did ring, and it was King Hussein. And at first I thought it was my friend pulling my leg, but it turned out that it was indeed King Hussein. And he did want to meet. And I said, "Well, I'd be happy to meet you. Just tell me how did I go about doing that." And he said, no, I want to come to your home." So he said, "It's a bit complicated, and we need to have the Royal Canadian Mounted Police involved for security aspects, et cetera, et cetera." And I said, "Well, whatever it takes." So we were vetted. We had the RCMP come and visit my home and tell me some guidelines that would be in place and that the visit could be for an hour, et cetera, et cetera. The next day, the convoy of RCMP vehicles and a black limousine arrive, and out of the limousine jumps JY1. He rushes to the front door, knocks on the door. I open the door and come in, and we go through the pleasantries, and you know, I'm not sure how to call him. And he said, "Well, just call me Hussein." And I said, "Well, you know, what do we do? Would you like something to drink?" And he said, "Well, I'd take some tea." So we had tea, and he finished his tea, and he said, "Okay, now I want to go to the shack." So we went to the shack, and he said, I want to operate." I said, "Okay." So we set the station up. He started to make some QSOs, and he was quite active as JY1 portable VE7 for about 45 minutes or so. And then there was a knock on the front door, and I went to the door, and it was one of the officials that had been waiting outside. He said, "We have to go. We have another meeting to go to, and King Hussein is very busy." So I went back to the shack and said to Hussein, I said, "They're telling me that you have to go, that you've got other places to go." And he said to me, "I'm operating amateur radio. I'm the king. I will decide when I go." So he operated for a few more minutes, but then left.
Wow, that's a great story. What advice would you give to new or returning hams to the hobby?
Well, I think, again, as I have reiterated throughout this QSO Today podcast, the sharing and making friends and continuing to learn is the important thing for anyone to take, not just the everyday QSOs, which are a large and interesting part, but the ability to share what you know and learn, to make friends that will last a lifetime, and to continue to learn the new and interesting things that we are open to through amateur radio. You know, the changes with the addition of the computer world have been huge, and the effect on amateur radio. And rather than trying to stay status quo, learn about those things and allows you to enjoy life to its fullest.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. I want to thank you so much for joining me on the QSO Today podcast, Dale.
Well, it's my pleasure and indeed my honor to be considered and the opportunity to share my story with others. And I hope that they will find it interesting and intriguing and perhaps spurn them on to do something new and different, either inside or outside our wonderful hobby.
And if they have a chance to visit you in one of the endless summers, they should certainly look you up.
Absolutely. I insist upon it.
73, Dale.
73, Eric.
That concludes this episode of QSO Today. I hope that you enjoyed this QSO with Dale. Please be sure to check out the show notes that include links and information about the topics that we discussed. Go to www.qsotoday.com and put in VE7SV in the search box at the top of the page. If you'd like to sponsor the transcription of this episode or any of the previous QSO Today episodes into written text, the cost is $67. There is a button on the right side of the show notes page to start this process. Show your support for the QSO Today podcast by becoming a listener sponsor for a nominal monthly fee. This really does help to defray my expenses to produce, host, and distribute the QSO Today podcast directly to you. Please check out the options for listener support on the show notes page. QSO Today is available in the iTunes Store and now a host of podcast services and applications. I still recommend Stitcher and Pocket Casts for your computer or smartphone. Until next time, this is Eric, 4Z1UG, 73. The QSO Today podcast is a product of KEG Media Incorporated, who is solely responsible for its content.